Welcome to Great Minds for this very special Climatech edition. We are now on the back end of Climatech. Big success, and we had Aaron there with us, along with our dear friends and partners from Hydro-Québec last week in Boston. And Aaron is the Adirondack Wilderness Campaign Director, leading a campaign around clean water, jobs, and wilderness. He has a long time presence in this space, originally hails from my state, New York, but has been all over the country and really on the front lines of the climate crisis long before any of us knew what it was or that it was coming. So it is a pleasure to get a chance to talk to you, Aaron, and I am thrilled that Ben and the Hydro-Québec team put us together here for this special Climatech edition of Great Minds.
Well, this is indeed an honor. One minor correction, literally around the world. Some of our early pressing arguments going back to Bali in 2001, a lot working with the Global South, which is basically non-frontline nations, basically Global South is Latin America, continental Africa, Asia, really, you know, pushing toward not only climate equity and action on climate, because again, these countries are the last to industrialize, but really are going to be bearing some of the frontline burdens and advocating in that space, but also domestically within the United States since the toxic waste and race study. And I'm one of the pioneers in what would become the environmental justice movement, which is now a global movement relative to frontline communities of Black, Indigenous, and Latin and Asian communities around the globe, advocating not only up to Paris for a strong Article 5, which would absolutely revolutionize the effort, but also the just transition. The thing is not, you know, that we're facing a crisis, but we also have an opportunity to change and transform the world economy along the clean energy space. So think of it, up to the 21st century or the 20th century was the age of carbon and combustion. And the beginning of the 21st century is going to be the new age of clean tech and clean technology. And what is that going to look like? And more importantly, how are we going to scale up to meet the challenges, whether nationally, but also with labor and all the factors that got to go into blazing this new path and this new way forward? So several things are happening in this space. Not only is the advocacy of that clean technology, what are the relationships, but how will nations invest? How will the private sector invest and engage? But also, you know, that's on the positive end and how to look forward. But, you know, we're talking about people who have trillions of dollars, whole nation states, petrol states, that will be what they call stranded assets. And whether it is petroleum or whether it is fossil fuels and coal or gas or any other carbon-based current technology, they're not going to go quietly into the night. So how do we engage that transportation? How do we get them to transition to clean energy and invest in this new market and new economy? But again, how does that affect their bottom lines? And that bottom lines right now, a lot of their capital, a lot of banking, a lot of investment assets are actually in dirty and fossil fuel. And so right now, how do we make that pivot? In Canada, the United States, this is a very active frontline conversation. We're fighting at, not only are we fighting to expand clean energy, but we're also nations that are also expanding carbon exploration, so to say, you know, whether it's the tar sands in Western Canada, or the United States with its various exploration efforts, not only domestically, even in the Antarctic and the Arctic. So we are trying to shape and guide that conversation in a way that weans our nations off of fossil fuels, but also advance and expand clean technology and clean energy. And specifically, as it relates to Hydro-Québec, a major asset in the Northeast is this asset called, you know, water and converting that water to hydroelectricity, all the players centering around that, but also now the true transformation of the grids from Canada all the way through to the United States. The United States, New York City, since you're from New York, you can't go anywhere without seeing a telephone pole. That's 1920s infrastructure. But yet it's tagged onto our bills as if it's a current asset that they're investing in. We're still paying line charges for infrastructure that goes back to the 1920s. So not only are we paying for old stuff and we're paying double or triple for that, but it's not clean, you know, and it needs to be transformed. So new grids, new technologies, new pathways forwards, and the climate tech conversation in Boston, in the Northeast, is right where the sweet spot of where the action needs to happen. We got offshore wind coming in. I was part of the effort to get the first installation of five offshore wind turbines off of Block Island and part of the bigger and growing national conversation on the continental shelf of offshore wind. That's one leg of the table. There is solar and geothermal. That's another leg of the table. But the other big asset that's yet to be fully engaged is hydro. And that's another leg of the table. And that's why climate tech is where we, as I say, got a lot of great minds that are in that space, but also all the other ancillary solutions that are around that space. So this was an important conversation. And I'm glad, and I want to thank the mayor of Boston and the governor of the state of Massachusetts for kicking this thing off. This was just a powerful thing. I just wish my governor was there. But, you know, I think that's going to happen.
Well, I sure hope so. So let's go back and we share, we're about the same age. I graduated 2 years after you, and we shared one of our majors, sociology. Sociology, I always think, doesn't get enough respect as it really should. In many ways, it teaches you how things really work and how you can look at the world and sort of figure out what's going on, right? In the most fundamental way.
It's the most foundational, granular aspect of how society is formed, how communities, how groups all come together to make our wonderful democracy. It is the bedrock of anthropology. It's the bedrock of political science. All these other sciences build on top of the phenomena of sociology. And when you look at human communities and how they build and shape communities and how they build and shape civil societies, nations, and how they come together to advance, going from following what we something a sociological term or our model is called Maslow's hierarchy of need. As you move up in this hierarchy, going from saving of oneself and shelter needs to the next level of community needs to the next level of professional, and then with all that is occurring within a rubric of a state or a nation state, and we basically pass laws, regulations, and policies that fulfill those varying needs of humanity as we build and expand culture and our civil society. So it is a very foundational science, and it's very powerful because it goes right to the crux of the phenomenon on how our economies are put together, how we generate wealth and power, but as they say, jobs, etc. So you understand intimately all the factors that go into the various relationships that create and basically help organize a society. So then sociology is that foundation, that science of studying that human behavior and those relationships.
Right. And how society is layered economically and everything else related to economics. Let's talk about an issue that has got to be one of the core tenets of what you've been dealing with on the environmental justice front. And that's the issue of food security and how the climate crisis hurts those least prepared to deal with it. You have a global perspective. There's stuff going on right now. This is not 10, 20 years off in the future.
Absolutely. Well, first and foremost, what we're witnessing right now as we talk about climate change, this is not about weather. Weather is a subset or cross-section as we monitor day, weekly, monthly, yearly. It's climate is, as I say, the whole global system that is everything that deals with water, air, the flow of currents within our ocean, the flow of currents within the air and the atmosphere. We have something called the jet stream. And so pretty much up to the early part, you know, just at the beginning of the 21st century, the jet stream was kind of wobbly, but was still fairly stable and okay. The jet stream, think of it like we are a sphere going through the solar system. We're going around the sun. And as we rotate on our axis, there are air currents on top. And so they're spinning like a top. And so it's like a little, think of it like a donut or a halo, but on the northern hemisphere, as I say, of the Arctic, and the southern hemisphere of the Antarctic. And what happens with seasons as the Earth tilts on its axis as it goes through the year, that jet stream is very critical to the movement of atmosphere clouds and gases and things that pretty much give us the ability to predict our weather. Now, we understand other factors such as ocean temperatures. This is what influences El Nino and La Nina, insofar as it also impacts with air atmospheric climate. So as these things spin, we know that there's the transport of weather and warmth and moisture from the oceans over lands and sea. And this is a very critical aspect of what we call a stabilized climate. Well, what happens when you heat the Earth up? Well, they've learned actually since the early 20th century that the Earth was going through a warming. This was not widely publicized and circulated, but the coal sector and the petrochemical sector knew that greenhouse gases were trapping more heat. And so what was happening over time, more water would evaporate. So greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide, methane, these are the ones that are definitely byproducts and connected with fossil fuel burning and production. And that is what I call up until a point an independent variable that we as a human, as a species, were contributing. So over time, they recognize that there was this increase in temperature. But recent scientists, and this is where they talk about the 97, now 99% of scientists concur that anthropogenic or human burning of fossil fuels has led to a warming and an increase in global temperature. So what does that mean? Well, as the Earth heats up, it destabilizes that thing called the polar vortex. And so instead of it spinning like a top, it starts to get really wobbly. So for thousands of years, our species has evolved within a very stable climate that we, as they say, up until the early part of the 21st century, we enjoyed. And now we're at a global climate temperature that hasn't been around for over 100 million years. So it predates our existence as a species. So we're now living in a climate created by our action that our species never evolved in or developed in. And add to that its impacts on the stable global climate that has been around, since the Ice Age. And so what we're witnessing now with that disruption is that places that are warm or tropical are getting hotter, places north are getting wetter. The other greenhouse gas that is dependent upon a warming planet is called water vapor. People don't realize that water vapor is a greenhouse gas. So, with more water vapor, that's even more heat that we are trapping in this piece. Bill McKibben wrote a great book called The End of Nature. And what the end of nature and the punchline of the end of nature that people go, well, what does that mean, the end of nature? Is it, well, nature, up until the 20th century, had the ability to heal and regulate and pull, the planet back to, as they say, the global norm. Well, because we have dumped so much fossil fuels into the atmosphere, and because we're now on an accelerated path of global warming, nature no longer has the capacity to cool the planet. So now aggressive action on behalf of humanity must happen in order for us to stabilize or try to stabilize the planet below a 2 degrees Celsius increase in temperature. Paris want to keep us, unlock us, try to get us at an action that's 1.5 degrees, but we're going well beyond that, and we have actually not reduced at the rate that we should have. Granted, we're doing tremendous changes insofar as the creation of new, cleaner, greener technology, but the issue now is not about whether or not we can start to do something. The issue is scale and really pivoting nation states and nation governments to act on climate. You hit on the very sensitive areas that nations that, especially around the tropics, and many of those are in developing nations, they are facing massive droughts, massive climate impacts, huge impacts insofar as tropical rains that have now gone to become tr from tropical seasonal to biblical rains. We're having something, let's say, an atmospheric river storm. So a place that may have saw, 1 or 2 inches, maybe 5 inches at a really bad tropical storm are now seeing 11, 12, often sometimes 20 inches of rain, which is a case like Libya, where there was that massive rainstorm that they, again, a rainstorm that occurred over Libya that hadn't been seen in almost 500 to 1,000 years, but a dam broke and it killed thousands. And again, that's an example of a third world nation having a real critical and catastrophic impact. But these impacts are happening in developing nations more often and more frequently, with huge, massive losses in life, cattle, land, and their ability, as they say, to have meaningful economies that, again, that will help them. So right now, climate is producing severe impacts on these nations that have to now spend billions of dollars that they don't have to try to become resilient and protect themselves from a global, you know, climate that's now more destabilized. And we too, the United States, is also facing it. We're also seeing these various storms and consequences, and we're also witnessing the loss of casualty with regards to humanity, but also property. Right now, coastal areas in the United States, you can measure it in where the insurance companies are no longer underwriting insurance. States like Florida, I would say going from Virginia on south, as the impacts of climate change have now produced frequent storms that are now, instead of hundreds of millions of dollars worth of damages, which still allow insurance companies to be profitable, to now mega billion dollar storms. And so much so that companies are divesting from those areas. So people in places like Florida, South Carolina, Georgia, along the Gulf Coast, no longer can get underwriters. So the cost is immediate, real, and clearly economic ramifications domestically within the United States are higher than they've ever been, but clearly also around the globe, people are facing frontline consequences and that are catastrophic, that are directly related to the elevated temperatures that are, and the destabilized global climate. And that destabilized, again, going back to that polar vortex, that's now wobbly, producing these storms all around the globe.
All right, so we're going to find a way, and we'll weave our way back to a positive part of the story here.
And, of course. I don't want to wrap it in doom.
No. Yeah.
You know, the doom is the fire, or the thing that lights the fire under our butts to actually engage in this work. And that's why Hydro-Québec is really bullish, and that's why we need massive action that can really shift the needle within two very significant countries, Canada and the United States. We can do something that hasn't been done, and we now must do, and we must not, it's not, you know, climate solutions are not just a domestic national solution. It is a global effort going back to Paris. So we have a new unique relationship with Canada and the United States that we can absolutely do things on a scale that is significant, impactful, meaningful, but truly bending that needle in a direction that we want to bend it.
Yeah, no, very much so. And that was a hallmark of, and very purposeful of, Climate Tech, is not doom and gloom. But let's just, you have the benefit, Aaron. It's not often we speak to someone who has been at this game as long as you have. Going back 30 years, give or take, to the Arbor Hill Environmental Justice Corporation and your time working with the White House Council on Environmental Quality, you have the benefit of perspective and time. Talk about what were the big agenda items then and those that we have acted on and those that we have just continued to push to the bottom of the pile.
Well, two things. Back in the early 80s, there wasn't anything called the environmental justice movement. And the environmental justice movement is not minority or black environmentalism. It's not segregated, because the environment doesn't care about your wealth, your color, or your status. But what happened is that we found that there was a powerful relationship with public policy at the government level and land use and the impacts on certain communities. And something what we call LULUs, locally unwatered land uses, or the thing called NIMBY. Everybody heard about NIMBY, not in my backyard. Well, by the time you start to scale that up, you know, the impacts on communities, you know, you may try to make your yard and your area, your neighborhood, your suburbs nice and clean and green, but your garbage has to go somewhere. Your sewage has to go somewhere. So there are parts of our civil society where there are what we call positive amenities like parks, open space, all these things that, as they say, add value to your home, your property, et cetera. But there's the negative amenities. They got to go somewhere. Somebody's got to put in a sewage treatment plant. Somebody has to put in a landfill. And we as a civil society have a hell of a solid waste problem. Everything from construction waste all the way down to putrescible waste, which is your stuff that you throw in the garbage can after every meal, et cetera, the rotting stuff. And what we found, actually, Dr. Charles Lee, Bernice Miller Travis, and Dr. Ben Chavis of the United Church of Christ, they did a study called The Toxic Waste and Race in 1987. And under my hats is I'm a retired epidemiologist from the New York State Health Department. So when you have a big data set where you're starting to look at a phenomenon and you're measuring it, and you can come up with a statistical predictable probability of outcomes, that's a very significant study. And what they call court-ready outcomes, so where you can move beyond opinion, anecdotal, or unproven, you know, the so-called evidence, you know, the thing that courts rely upon, that's when you have something that can be called or defined something. So what if they found at the end of the day, looking at all of the toxic sites and waste landfills around the country, they found that, and again, this is the aggregation of land use policy decisions that every zoning board or town or planning or economic development have decided how land or geography is going to be used. What they found is that when that decision-making authority was let since the founding of the nation up to currently, most of the negative land use decision-making went, and that's where they put it, next to, around, or on communities of color, reservations. And so the poorest of the poor, the minority of the minorities, these were the communities which became the dumping ground for the affluence and benevolence of the America that we enjoy. So for our suburbs and for all the things about our corporate urban cores and our beautiful skylines, all the waste products, all the byproducts and waste from construction or whatever was ultimately dumped in these communities that did not and were not aware that they were being targeted. And at the time, and as I say, and this is where the political science and the sociology comes in, from the local decision makers, they were basically what we call the path of least resistance. So they knew that certain entities, if you dump it there or put it there, it would be voted out of office. And so when you think about how politics and the political science of it, you know, from their minds, they weren't being racist. They were like, look here, we know that if we put it over here, they're not going to come at us at the middle class or the affluent class, which at that time, because again, because of racial stratification, the suburbs are predominantly white. So one of the things that this study ended up showing was how our society and how public policy, often discriminatory, results in land use policies that are discriminatory, even down to what we call negative amenities that society needs, like dumps, sewage treatment plants. And so what the study found that, you know, your race mattered regardless of your wealth status, because when they started creating the black middle class and building a middle class and affordable housing, they did it on the cheapest land. And so the cheapest land in many cases in many urban areas around the country, like Jacksonville, Florida, were the old former landfills. So they basically built, you know, middle class housing for the up and coming black and Hispanic middle class in Florida in the 50s on landfills. And just like we learned with Love Canal, which occurred in the late 70s, the gases and the leaching of toxins that you build these houses on top of, in the case of Love Canal, is a poor working class white community. And Hooker Chemical Camp had dumped all that had landfilled and had barrels of this stuff underneath the ground. And they built all this new working class, middle class housing, which basically gave us the Superfund Act. But that was one case, again, when whites were exposed, they took action and they created national standards, which is CERCLA, which is our Superfund laws, to make sure we protect human health and the environment. But guess what? That seems to be where they stopped. So the toxic waste and race study comes along 10 years later and says, no, you've been doing this stuff, not only to poor working class, but hey, you've been doing this to people of color. And if you control for poor working class whites and blacks, you'll find that, yes, there's even a preference there. So no matter what, your race mattered. And that was the power of that study. And at that time, I was in the middle of fighting against a solid waste incinerator that was producing then state-of-the-art clean energy for the government complex of the state of New York. And so that means all the state capital government, our entire government largesse, relied upon a solid waste incinerator that burned garbage for an 8-county suburban region in the heart of a black community. And naturally, it was sold as if you build it here, you're going to get jobs and low electricity. Two things didn't happen. They didn't get jobs, and they didn't get low electricity costs. And the community, the city of Albany, they got tens of millions of dollars every year for tipping fees to burn garbage. Did not invest, not $1 million, not $500,000. Not even $100,000, not even $50,000 in any amenity. They didn't give the kids a playground out of it. But yet they burned and collected millions of dollars and lowered the taxes for the city and the middle class, but all at the expense of the health and well-being of the Black community. So that was the height of it, what we call then environmental racism. And at the point where it's that determinative, where people actually know and then profit from it and make and continue to make. That's when the environmental justice movement. So I was at the cutting edge of the movement. We did not know we were building a movement. We also, out of it came the health disparities movement, bioaccumulation, cumulative impacts. All these things, these terminology came out of this movement. And it was because of the science and the pioneering science of public health and epidemiology. All these new science were just uncovering, in fact, whole new fields. Right now, you can get law degrees now, public health degrees, municipal urban planning degrees. That go right back to this pioneering work that we did in the 80s. And so not only did I fight with regards to solid waste, but led some of the most pioneering and significant legislation, not only with regards to federal regulation, but even voting rights, because we recognized, again, remember I said it was politicians that decide land use. So we were able to innovatively show under Section 5 and Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, that if communities did not get the power to choose politicians or their representatives, the politicians would basically make decisions that adversely impact them. So that was the first time environmental justice was used, even in a voting rights case that revolutionized even the law within that field. So yes, at the foundation of that, and that's, one of the benefits of it, I just recently had my papers and my works taken by the United States Library of Congress, and now they will be part of a new environmental justice collection at the national level. And by the way, I'm still involved with the White House Commission on Environmental Quality. I'll be down there in a couple of weeks meeting with some allies again, but this time on the Justice 40 initiative, as well as the Inflation Reduction Act and investment in what we call the Green New Deal.
Amazing, amazing. And we didn't mention your tenure with the Sierra Club, which is also incredible.
Yes, that got me to where I'm at right now in the innovative area because, why, given my background, am I in the wilderness? Well, it's been one of my areas of study, but one of the things that, again, my core is as a scientist is that those things that sequester the carbon that can actually bend the needle. And so the president moved in an area called 30 by 30 when he got elected in 2020. And that was the gunshot to me because I knew that was an area that there's going to be underinvestment. But that's an area where the northeastern part of the United States and a lot of Canada, what we have is this wilderness carbon sink that we're not going to just build our way out of it with all the offshore wind and hydro. But we can absolutely leverage flora and fauna to actually sequester carbon from the atmosphere. And because there are few people in this space, there needs to be that proverbial Moses on the mountain. So being an African American in that space, and being an ardent environmentalist, the 57th John Muir of the Sierra Club. So I was wearing John Muir's shoes for a term, but advocating on the wilderness carbon sequestration, because not only are we facing a climate crisis, we're facing a biodiversity crisis, and these things go hand in hand. And so you need some of the best and brightest experts in this field at the helm and at the levers of public policy, decision-making, and power. And so this is why I've centered on this space within the Adirondacks in North Country, so because it does several things. Because in preserving and protecting wilderness, we protect ecological watersheds that are critical to everything from hydro all the way down to the biodiversity that depends upon those watersheds. And that is the blue gold that exists in the northeast of the United States and Canada. So again, seeing the opportunity where it's at the height of this crisis. And being through that door, it's not an accident. I said, this is where the next movement and needle's going to be. And you don't want to be there after the fact. That's why you got to be there at the front end. And so when it's coming down, you're able to work with the various players and policymakers and businesses that are in these spaces to get them to not move in a way of fear, but in a way of cooperation and collaboration to as I say, grow our way out of this current crisis.
So your passion and knowledge of the subject is unmatched. We talk about doom and gloom, and that's what lights a fire. But somehow, and this was a big part of Climatech, we find the optimism, often driven by technical innovation. Talk about, Aaron, where you find the optimism.
Well, I find the joy through not only, you know, we got the crisis, which is definitely the thing that brings everybody in the room. But through this movement, the environmental justice movement, through my actions as a wilderness advocate and advocating, as I say, on behalf of John Muir, I found how to speak, and again, through pull people into the room. Because again, technology absence of context fails. You got to have that human context. But here you need more than the human context. You need the human and the ecological and the biodiversity context to pull these pieces together and meld a pathway forward, a solution set forward that not only respects the technology, but more importantly, respects the people that for which technology has to serve. A lot of folks are technocrats. You know, some people love to shoot rockets to the moon and say, well, everybody's rockets. We got to worship that at the expense of all impacts on all humanity. The question is not, do you send a rocket to the moon? Is why are you sending the rocket to the moon? And more importantly, how is humanity elevated by this experience? It's when we take a chauvinistic point of view and write off what's desirable technology-wise, wealth-wise, and not look at the impacts on humanity, that we become poorer as a global community, poorer as a national community, but we then fall back on the very traps that got us into this crisis in the first place. We saw the power of fossil fuels, and the power of fossil fuels can revolutionize transportation, production, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's now taking us to the 21st century to realize that myopic point of view now is going to be killing and is killing the planet. So now we have to now find a new way forward. So we also not only need to find a new way forward insofar as the product that allows us to, as I say, provide electricity, transportation, all the things that give us comfort, the lights, the technology that you and I are using right now. We have to find a cleaner and greener way of doing that. But to do that, you have to have a deeper appreciation of you and I, the humanity on the side of the mics, but also the flora and fauna upon which we enjoy, which we consume, which we depend. But like John Muir said, it's all connected together. So that deeper sociology is building that human context into, that empathy into, as we deal with the technology. There must be not only a deeper, powerful technology, but with a deeper empathy and love to serve as humanity, protect humanity, and save humanity. So there's a purpose in that. And that's why it's an all hands on deck. That's why the governor is important. The mayor is important. Everybody can't take their eye off the ball, because not only must they provide the finances and support, but more importantly, they must pass the laws and public policies that transform our behavior, how we utilize our and stewards of the things that we right now take for granted. We walk in a room and turn a light on and switch on. We take for granted that there will be light. We turn a faucet tap. We take for granted that there will be water. But we don't think about the wastewater. We don't think about all the other stuff that we do. So now pulling that all together, the climate tech is not only just the solutions, even the technology that will transform the waste streams, okay, that transform, you know, our water sewer infrastructure. There are companies that want to buy up all the water rights, but they don't want to buy the sewage, you know. So, you know, these things, you know, we think and thinking big and looking at technology that serves from cradle to grave all humanity. This is, as I say, I call an old but new frontier. We're now thinking deeper about how we use this technology. It's more than can we make a buck, but the question is the value it brings to humanity, our existence, but drives human action, drives us to a place that we live more sustainably, you know, but also pull us back from the brink of a disaster that is basically anthropogenic, basically man and human made. So Bill McKibben wrote about the end of nature. We now have to talk about how humanity can step in and do its role to actually now help nature in a way that nature has taken care of us for millennia.
Well, Dr. Aaron Mayer, it is a joy to talk to you. You can't help but even amidst all the doom and gloom and all the statistics and everything that's happening in the North and South Poles and in between in the oceans, to find a way forward and to be optimistic. I'm so pleased the Hydro-Québec people brought you into our lives and to Climate Tech in Boston, and that we got a chance to have a real conversation here on Great Minds. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Have a great day.